Well, we'll be continuing our study on gender roles as described in the Bible. And I have to apologize because I have one of these things where my right ear is completely stopped up. And so it's very difficult for me to hear. And I don't know what I sound like to myself. So we'll muddle through as best as we can. Now, you recall what we have talked about thus far in our study is that all of the major passages in the New Testament that trace the relationships of male and female specifically always take us back to the creation story in Genesis chapters 1 and 2. And when we look at some of those passages in particular, we'll see that there's some judgment involved in making that affirmation. But certainly it's extremely clear in a number of other passages Paul will reason that the reason relationships between men and women are such as they are is because man was created first, and secondly, because woman was created relative to the man and serving some purpose in regard to him. And so that shows us that the differences between men and women are not simply cultural conditioning, that if we just were more enlightened people and we could get away from all of the baggage of our ancestors, that we could come up with some world in which males and females are just completely identical to one another or something like that. And we noted, of course, at the end of the study last week that there clearly are biological differences between males and females. I don't know of any culture that has gotten so warped yet that denies that difference. And for one who is a believer in the Creator, that God is the one who chose there to be differences between men and women, that's ultimately the reason why God wanted it that way. God chose that. He could have certainly created human beings any number of ways if he wanted to. Well, reflecting that choice by God, then is it beyond reason that there may be other differences between men and women that are not as noticeable as the biological differences, so to speak. Then we noted there were a second set of passages that are still rooted in the creation, but also have to do with covenant obligations of marriage, in which we talk about the relationship of a husband and a wife specifically, not just men and women generally. And so that's the kind of the overview we're going to be looking at today in terms of these covenant obligations. And maybe this is a fortuitous lesson in light of an upcoming wedding ceremony here. Hopefully the parties involved have studied these things long before now. So maybe it'll be a good refresher. So first of all, we want to think of marriage as a covenant. And that's why we refer to these as covenant obligations. What obligations, responsibilities do we have that stem from the covenant that we enter into in marriage? Marriage is certainly the most intimate of all human relationships that we can experience in this life. It is rooted in the creation because not only was Adam and Eve the first man and woman, biologically speaking, but they were also created as husband and wife and joined together to be this family that was then tasked with going forth, being fruitful, multiplying, and filling the earth, and so on. And so what we're focusing on today, in addition to all the general things that we've seen so far about men and women, what are the additional obligations and responsibilities that male and female have when they choose to enter into a marriage covenant? Now, the point of this would be that if you never got married, you would still have certain responsibilities based upon being male or female and how you relate to the opposite sex and all of that. You can avoid these covenant obligations if you choose not to get married. But if you choose to get married, you are assuming upon yourself the obligations that God has put within the boundaries of the marriage covenant. And this covenant, we need to remember, is a covenant between not just the man and the woman, but also with God. Let's look at a couple of passages along this line. Would someone like to turn to Proverbs chapter 2? I have a volunteer that wants to turn to Proverbs 2. Okay, we'll let Travis take Proverbs 2 here. All right, Malachi chapter 2. I need a volunteer for Malachi chapter 2. Okay, we'll let Greg take that one. And then Isaiah chapter 50. Someone like to take Isaiah chapter 50. There's only going to read a verse or two here, so... okay, so in Proverbs chapter 2, we're going to read verses 16 and 17.
So you will be delivered from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God.
Okay, so obviously this gets into this perversion of the marriage covenant in adultery, or the warning of the father to the son to avoid that pitfall. And talks about leaving the companion of her youth and forgetting the covenant of her God. And so clearly marriage is being spoken of in a covenant kind of nature there. Okay, Malachi chapter 2, verse 14. Okay, so God has been a witness against you because of how you've dealt with your wife and been treacherous and disloyal because there is a covenant relationship here that has been betrayed. All right, what about Isaiah chapter 50 and verse 1? Charlie? Okay. Now this reflects, of course, really several other passages we could look at throughout the Old Testament about God portraying his relationship with, well, both Israel and Judah, actually, as a husband with a wife. And she's been unfaithful to the covenant of marriage. And so he uses the language of divorcing her, putting her away because of her infidelity. And then Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 8 is another passage where the Lord describes taking Israel as his bride. I passed by you and saw you, and behold, you were at the time for love, so I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. I also swore to you and entered into a covenant with you so that you became mine, declares the Lord God. And you might compare that with old Ruth chapter 3 and verse 9, where this kind of removal of the covering, that covering, you know, symbolizes the protection of a marriage. And that's some of the language that's being used here in Ezekiel as well as of God. But again, he talks about entering into a covenant with them. Well, that's the point that we're looking at here, is that marriage is spoken of several times in the Bible as this covenant. And I think a lot of us have at least a basic idea about what a covenant is. It's an agreement between two parties. There's a kind of a vow or a real strong kind of commitment that's being made here. But I think there's even something more fundamentally significant about that that we need to realize as believers as we look into the Bible about this business of the covenant. The passage about marriage that really roots it as a covenant is found in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, which is a very familiar passage to us. We mentioned this last week, that in the original telling of the story of Adam and Eve, you get this commentary in verse 24, which really wouldn't apply to Adam and Eve in the sense that they didn't have father and mother to leave and, you know, go off and do this. But it is a comment by the inspired writer that this principle, however, that was exhibited with Adam and Eve is replicated in all subsequent marriages. And what exactly does he mean by this? What is he saying? Well, you notice I have highlighted these two words, leave and cleave, and it's just really a complete fluke of English language that those two words sound so similar. Also, that the word cleave has two meanings to it. I think a lot of people have cleaved their marriage pretty good in the sense of like a butcher cleaver and cutting it in two. And so the word cleave can mean to separate two things from one another or to glue them together. And of course, that's the sense in which this word is being used here. So for this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now, the reason I highlighted these two words is because when you look through the Bible, God is constantly describing himself in a covenant relationship with all kinds of people. His covenant with his creation in the beginning, his covenant with all flesh in the days of Noah, with Abraham, with Moses, with David, with Israel. Every single relationship that God has ever had with anybody throughout the Old Testament was described in terms of a covenant that he established with them. The second thing you need to realize is that in those covenants, the language that is used to describe these covenants are these two words. They occur over and over and over again. they may not always be the English words leave and cleave. Often you'll recognize the word something like forsake or cling to or something like that. But they are covenant terms for breaking a covenant relationship that you have and establishing a new covenant relationship. And so what's being called for here is not merely geographically relocate yourself somewhere other than where your parents are, but rather your primary covenant relationship in life is to your parents when you're born into that family, and that's who you submit to and you respect and honor and so on. But when the time of marriage comes, what you are doing is you're recognizing that this is no longer to be the primary covenant responsibility that one has. That is being nullified and set aside and is being replaced by a new covenant relationship, which is now going to be between the man and the woman. And so there's more to it than just, don't let your in-laws stick their noses into your affairs and meddle. And, there's all kinds of practical advice there and the trouble you can avoid in doing that. But there's something much more fundamentally profound here about a recognition of where the covenant exists and what the responsibilities are in that covenant relationship. Well, let's look at a couple of passages that we might see this language being used here. How about Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 25? Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 25. Matter of fact, if you just turn over to Deuteronomy, we'll just take our examples from here because they are concentrated in the same area here that we can turn to them all rather quickly. So Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 25. Now, the context of this is the judgment that comes against Israel because of their unfaithfulness, and then people will say, why has this happened? This devastation and destruction, what happened here? And men will say, because they forsook the covenant of Yahweh, the God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. This is the same word that's used in Genesis 2:24, to leave father and mother. They left the Lord. They forsook the covenant that they had with the Lord. Then over in chapter 31, verses 16 and 17, the Lord said to Moses, behold, you are about to lie down with your fathers, and this people will arise and play the harlot with the strange gods of the land, into the midst of which they are going, and will forsake me and break my covenant which I have made with them. And then my anger will be kindled against them in that day, and I will forsake them and hide my face from them, and they will be consumed, and many evils and troubles will come upon them, so that they will say in that day, is it not because our God is not among us that these evils have come upon us? And so here you see it's kind of a two-way street. They forsake the Lord, and so the Lord forsakes them. Now, We need to realize a certain degree of which language is being used here, like in Isaiah 50. Is God really the wife of the husband of Israel? Israel's really his wife. He really did go out and get a certificate of divorce and put her away. I suspect that's not how we should understand that, as much as it's just language and illustration and analogy that's being used. And in the same way, when it says the Lord forsook his people, you'll find several other passages where God will say he never forsakes his people. And then you could say, oh, there's a Bible contradiction here. But again, keeping things in their context, we understand the point that's being made here is you have turned away from this covenant that I had with you. You refuse to honor your responsibilities and obligations. And so those things that the Lord would do for his people, like bless them, as part of his covenant responsibility, they will not receive the blessing. They will receive a curse instead. So it really becomes more of a, you know, how this covenant relationship functions.
Well, is this in the chapter in verse in Genesis here that we're talking about, does this have more to do with just sort of authority situation where you're no longer, you know, really under authority of your parents?
Right.
There are still things that you're under obligation. So is it more of just an authority covenant that's changing, or is there more?
Well, I think we'll get into that here in a little bit as we explore the nature of the covenant. But you're absolutely right. There are still responsibilities and obligations we have. It's not that we nullify the relationship we have with father and mother, but that it's transformed. And so once again, that's why I said the primary covenant relationship we have now is with, between the husband and the wife and no longer the parent and the child. And it does get to a good extent in regard to this question of authority, as we're going to see here in a moment. And that prompts me to make another observation here, that it's not always a dishonorable thing to break a covenant. You know, if we're breaking the covenant in the sense of breaking a vow that we have made, that's dishonorable. But when God forsakes his covenant with Israel, it's not because there's anything dishonorable on his part where he's acting contrary to his character or to his promises. In fact, he's acting completely consistent with his character and his promises because he told them, you will reap judgment and curses upon yourself if you are unfaithful. But what he is not doing is discharging the blessings of that covenant relationship because they have rejected those things. And so I think what we're understanding here is that this is God's plan from the beginning, that a man and a woman be joined together and establish this primary covenant relationship together, that as parents we're just temporary stewards of the souls of these children. And the goal is that when they become adults, they enter into this new relationship, and that's what God wants it to be. And so the time has come. It's not as if the covenant of parenthood is a perpetual, eternal covenant. And our children become adults, and we are no longer their parents in the sense of the relationship of parent and child authority, as Shane expressed it. We still have a relationship with them, but it is changed again because of the fact they've now become adults. And so it's a similar kind of thing as we see here between the Lord and us. So there are these honorable points at which a covenant dissolves, or it served its purpose, or is replaced or transformed. Kind of how the new covenant has replaced the old covenant's another kind of example of that.
Exactly. Yeah, the Old Testament was fulfilled by Christ.
Okay. Right. Okay. Now let's look at a couple of passages that focus on the cleaving side of this. Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 19 and 20. I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, the blessing and the curse. And under these Old Testament time period covenants, not just the ones in the Bible, but even among the Assyrians and the Egyptians and so on, they actually had these treaties written out, and they had a section called the blessings and the curses. And the blessings, you know, this is all the good things that'll happen if you're faithful to the covenant, and these are all the horrible things that'll happen if you violate the covenant. And lo and behold, here in Deuteronomy, when you get to chapter 27 and 28, you get these blessings and curses spelled out. And that's exactly what God is saying here. I've set before you life and death, or in other words, the blessing and the curse. You choose which one you want. So choose life in order that you may live, you and your descendants, by loving the Lord your God, by obeying His voice, and by cleaving to Him. For this is your life and the length of your days, that you may live in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them. And so, again, here's this cleaving to God is the language, again, of the covenant faithfulness that they would have. And one final one we might cite, chapter 10, verse 20, very short. You shall fear the Lord your God, you shall serve Him and cleave to Him, and you shall swear by His name. So again, that's just kind of a little illustration that this language of leave and cleave, or forsake and cling, or however you might want to translate it, it's the same Hebrew terms that are used throughout the Old Testament to talk about these covenant relationships as they are established or broken, and that's the same language that's being used here in Genesis chapter 2. And so that just goes along with the other passages that tell us marriage is a covenant, but even if we didn't have those passages, we would conclude that because this covenant language is being used to describe what marriage is, a setting aside of the covenant with father and mother, that it's no longer the primary relationship, and now a new relationship between the husband and his wife. Now, what's the importance of this covenant and recognizing marriage as a covenant? Well, the whole purpose of a contract, if you buy a house or a car or anything like that, the reason the legal system has evolved the way it has is because, obviously, if there's just an oral agreement between two people, there can be some vagueness about that, or people didn't quite understand one another clearly, or there's miscommunication of one kind or another, or somebody's memory is not too clear. And so if you spell all this out on paper, then you've got it, you know, expressed in black and white, and people know exactly what the terms are, what they're getting into, and so on, what's being agreed to. And then it also becomes the piece of paper you go back to and look at to judge whether each party has lived up to what it said it would do. And so, you know, if your water heater goes out and you call up the plumber you bought it from and you said, well, this isn't baking bread. Well, he probably says, well, it's not supposed to. You know, I didn't promise you a water heater is going to bake bread. Well, here it is in my contract. Well, if it was, then, you know, you got a point. But probably not there, right? So we have these kind of contracts so that we spell out exactly what's involved, and that becomes the standard by which we're judged. And that's what marriage is as well. And God is the one who spelled out for us what's expected of us in a marriage. And when we stand before Him on the day of judgment, this is what we're going to be judged by, whether we have lived up to our marriage responsibility. Another interesting thing about covenants is the smaller number of parties there are involved in a covenant, the more intimate and personal that covenant becomes. So it's kind of an inverse proportional relationship. You know, large number of people, less personal; small number of people, more personal. Well, you can see by that principle, a marriage covenant just between you and this one person becomes the most intimate of all relationships. And so idea of covenant takes on even more importance. I mean, when you're talking about a covenant between two nations, you know, I've conquered your nation and I'm telling you, you need to pay your taxes. I mean, that's pretty much what it is. Let's just pay our taxes and behave ourselves, and the you know, conquering king will leave us alone. But the covenant relationships and responsibilities we have that are more personal are much more significant and much more profound. And the fact that it's expressed in the form of a covenant reminds us that it really does involve a person's integrity, that, you know, the ancients, when they made these covenants, realized that they were making these promises not just to one another, but to God, who was a witness of that covenant. And so, when you kind of soberly, seriously contemplate what you're doing when you enter into this covenant and you're taking this vow, it is, you know, either you're just a low form of pond scum that doesn't mean what you say, or you realize the serious promise and commitment that you're making, and you're going to do everything you can to live up to that. That it is the vows, the promises that are made in the marriage relationship that become the real heart and soul of whether that relationship is going to work.
Well, I think that's part of the issue with people today. I mean, they don't view it as, you know, a covenant. They don't view it as, you know, an actual agreement and vows when they say the things that they do. I mean, it's almost like it's just, well, these are just the magic words that you have to say in order for the state to allow us to be, you know, wed. So, you know, we'll repeat the words and we can get our marriage license. But if things are bad,
well, it really raises the question, you know, if a person were to get married and they go through a ceremony and they say, you know, we'll stay together as long as it's convenient, or, you know, we're happy, are they really getting married? I mean, how is that any different than people say we're going to just live together and get a tax deduction or something? I mean, it does seriously raise the question of, do they even have an idea about what they're doing and making that commitment? It'd be like someone came forward and said, I want to be baptized. Why? Well, because I've been outside and I'm all hot and sweaty and I need a good bath. Oh, okay, you know, well, we got a new brother in Christ here. We'd say, no, you've not been baptized for the reasons the Bible says. You have no clue what you're doing. And I do think more and more we probably will see a lot of people who are, you know, they think they're getting married. They have a piece of paper from the state that says they're married. Of course, it won't be too long that you can get married your living room couch if you want to. And it becomes meaningless. But for marriage to be what God intends it to be, there does have to be this unconditional commitment to that marriage relationship. Well, the thing that we find as we look through the Bible about this covenant pattern is that in the covenants that are spoken of in the Bible, they're not covenants between two people that are of equal rank, I guess you might say. There is what people describe as the suzerain or the overlord or the emperor or the conquering king or whatever you want to call him, versus the vassal, the one who has been conquered, and so on. And so the role of the suzerain, and this, of course, in all those covenant relationships where God is described, he's the suzerain, he's the Lord. He's the initiator of the covenant blessings. He provides the covenant blessings. He maintains the covenant blessings. He protects the other party in this covenant. He's the benefactor. You get the idea about what this person's job is. And then the vassal, their job is to serve their Lord, to receive the covenant and the blessings, to show gratitude, to acknowledge their dependence upon him, and to be the beneficiary of the blessings he gives, and so on. Well, when you look at these, treaties that we have, again, just outside of the Bible, you know, it's clear that, God is using the language of the day to describe his own relationship with his people. Now, that's not to say his relationship is of the exact same nature, because God truly cared about his people. He wasn't just a conquering general. But he uses that language and says, now you people are familiar with these covenants. Well, I'm going to make a covenant with you, and it's going to be a real covenant, an even better covenant. And in this covenant, I'm going to assume the role of the Lord, and you're going to assume the role of the vassal, the underling. And when you look at these relationships that the different parties have, for example, the suzerain is said to love, to provide, protect, lead, honor, know, bless, carry, support, care for, or give refuge to. That's all language that's very typical of the suzerain, and it's language you'd recognize being very typical of God throughout the Old Testament. And then the vassal, on the other hand, is said to love, to fear, to serve, to submit, to honor, to respect, to obey, to thank, and to bless. And that language is very typical of Israel throughout the Old Testament. They're supposed to serve the Lord. They're supposed to bless the Lord. They're supposed to fear the Lord. They're supposed to give thanks to the Lord, and so on. Well, in that, you'll see that some responsibilities are interchangeable. Both parties are said to love the other, for example. And so those can be seen as interchangeable. Both are engaging in the same activity of loving, but not others. Because these roles are distinct and they're not interchangeable. If you're the vassal, then you're not the Lord, you know, and if you're the Lord, you're not the vassal. Now, those two may do the same thing, like love one another, but there are some things that are quite different. And so, for example, the suzerain is never said to submit to the vassal or to obey the vassal or to fear the vassal. And the vassal is never said to protect the Lord or to support the Lord in the sense of providing the actual things for him that the Lord is dependent upon the vassal. Well, you can see where I'm going with this, is that if the Bible is using this, speaking of marriage as a covenant and using covenant language of marriage, and the covenant pattern that we always find has this role of a suzerain and the role of a vassal, then you begin understanding exactly what the Lord intends of a husband and a wife, and that the husband is filling the role of the suzerain. He's to love his wife. He's to provide for her, to give her the blessings of you know, that covenant relationship and protect her and all these other things. And her part is to be thankful and submissive and obey and so on. And that's exactly what we find when we come to the New Testament now. And here are the four basic passages that explicitly describe the relationship of men and women in some detail. Matthew chapter 19, which we tend to focus on more as the divorce question. Ephesians chapter 5 and its parallel passage in Colossians chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3, and then 1 Corinthians chapter 6 on into chapter 7. And in most of these, Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24 is actually quoted and applied to the marriage relationship. And just to illustrate how these covenant obligations are reflected in the language that's used, just notice here in Ephesians chapter 5 how Paul describes the wife's responsibility toward her husband in these four ways, that she's to submit to him, she is to respect or fear him, she is to respond to him, and to become one with him. So why does Paul use this language? Well, because this is the same language we find used of that covenant party who's filling the role of that vassal, that one who's in a position not in authority, but under authority. And then we get back to that authority issue that Shane was talking about a moment ago, and that's exactly right. That the relationship of the suzerain and the vassal is an authority relationship in which the vassal is not the one giving the orders and the suzerain is the one obeying and submitting. It's the other way around. And the word submit always has this reference in the Bible to yielding to a higher authority. So parents that are submitting, children that are submitting to their parents, I misspoke because that's what you see all the time anymore. Oh, yesterday I saw, just couldn't believe this kid. Oh, man. Anyway, it was obvious who was controlling that family. But, children submit to the parents, the citizens submit to the government, slaves submit to their masters. And, of course, anytime you draw a comparison like that, you say women are slaves, women are children, women are to be treated like... No, that's not the point. The analogy is the nature of the relationship in which there is a higher authority and the other person is submitting to that and respecting that authority. That's what the Bible is teaching about this relationship of the husband and the wife. Well, lest the husband let all that go to his head, I get to be in charge. I'm the Lord of this relationship. Again, you see how Paul clarifies the responsibility of the husband. He is to love his wife, to lead her, to sacrifice himself for her, to sanctify her, glorify her, nourish and cherish her, also to become one with her. These words reflect the kind of responsibilities that the suzerain has toward the other person. Now, again, there's a wide breadth of which you'd see different suzerains and vassals. The Lord has radically transformed our understanding of how to apply this because he's not your typical kind of husband. You know, all marriage relationships are contaminated by sin and selfishness. And to the degree they are not perfect. And that's the things we need to work on. But Christ's relationship, he is perfect, of course, in the way he has conducted himself toward his bride. He perfectly loves and sacrifices himself and therefore becomes a model of how husbands wield authority. Yes, we do, but not in the worldly kind of sense, not as a CEO of a corporation or some conquering general or something like that. It is true love, sacrificial love, by which he is leading and guiding his wife and his family. And similarly, in 1 Peter chapter 3, and we'll look at these passages in some detail in the future. A little more abbreviated account here of how Peter puts it. But he says, also the wife is to submit to her husband, even if he's not a Christian. She is to obey him and call him Lord. You know, you ever think that was a little funny, like Sarah called Abraham Lord. So you women ought to call your husbands Lord. Well, I don't know that's a actual requirement to verbalize the word, because if my wife called me Lord, I'd think she was joking, I mean, almost mockery. Lord, here's your, whatever. It'd be kind of nice to try that for a while, but, But why is that, And, of course, the word Lord means to us something a little bit different. That's part of the kind of weirdness of it to us. But really what Peter is pointing out is that in the relationship Abraham and Sarah had, she acknowledged that he was her Lord. He was the master. He was the suzerain in this relationship. And so in the same way, Peter is reminding us that wasn't just true of Abraham and Sarah's relationship. This is what's true of marriage covenant in general. That's the role of the husband. It's the role of the wife. And so then in verse 7, he says that the husband is to know his wife, live with her in an understanding way. The New American Standard says, live with her according to knowledge. To know her, what does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean, two people are going to get married, need to spend some time together so they understand one another. Well, that's true. Again, there's some practical advice to that. But again, the word know is used as a covenant responsibility. How often in the Old Testament speaks of God knowing Israel? And what does that mean? It isn't simply that God has omniscience and knows everything. It refers to a very practical manifestation of his acting to fulfill his covenant responsibility toward the other party. We'll talk about that a little bit more, especially when we look at 1 Peter chapter 3, to honor her and treat her again as a weaker vessel, to care for her, provide for her, protect her, and so on. So anyway, that kind of gives us a general overview here of the covenant relationship as we're describing it here. And so, again, just to kind of recap, it's a divinely established covenant pattern with distinct roles for the suzerain, for the vassal. These responsibilities are assumed by the people that choose to enter into that relationship. If you don't want to be a vassal, don't get married. You know, if you don't want to be a suzerain and have that responsibility, don't get married. You know, you'll still have some general responsibilities as male and female, but these particular ones we've been talking about come to us because we are husbands or wives. And of course, it should go without saying, but it doesn't, that the distinction of roles doesn't have anything to do with value and who's better than another. They are equal before God, both made in the image of God. It's just they have different roles, just as the Father and the Son are equal, but have different roles. All right, well, we'll leave it at that for today. Appreciate your attention and comments this morning. And we'll continue with our study next week.